Hey everybody, welcome back to the Grey Malkin Lane Patreon channel. I am so happy to be joined by two friends that get to meet for the first time, Glenn Herdling and Demanda Martini. This is a wild combination of personalities, and I'm gonna have a great time just sitting back and smiling. And we are here to talk about my listeners know I love a 60s chick. I also love an early 70s chick. Lyra or Lyra, whichever way we decide to pronounce this name, is one of the arch foes of Namor, the Submariner. She is one of the most Real Housewives ready of all of the Marvel Comics characters. She's delicious and so over the top. She fucking chews the scenery. She is the Mr. Sinister of Lemuria. So we're gonna jump in to this nonsensical and wonderful character that most X-Men fans may only recognize from the Atlantis Attacks annuals when she was manipulating people into being brides of the Snake God. You know, that little storyline. We're gonna cover a lot quickly today, but this character's delicious and it's gonna be a ton of fun. First of all, let me welcome my two guests to the show, Glenn and Demand. I'll have you both introduce yourselves with your name and pronouns. Let us know your preliminary thoughts on Lyra or Lyra pronunciation, and what's your favorite story of hers? Let's begin with the incredible Glenn Herdling. Welcome back to Grey Malkin Lane.
Thank you very much, Chad. Glad to be here. Good to see you, Demanda. So the reason that I'm here, I worked at Marvel Comics back in the 80s and 90s, and I wrote Namor the Submariner for 2 years, probably the best time of my life. Loved writing that series. It was just phenomenal, and I loved bringing whom I call Lyra into the fold. And as I was saying before we started, Lyra, the reason I called her Lyra is that's what I thought her name was. When I said her name in front of Mark Gruenwald never challenged me on that, so I assume that I must have been saying it correctly.
We're gonna do a potato, potato, Lyra, Lyra. Let's call the whole thing off. Let me also welcome Demanda back to the show. Hi, my friend.
Hi. So for people who don't know me, and by this time on your channel, Chad, I think everybody does. But I'm a Washington, D.C. based drag performer and cosplayer. So Lyra, I knew that she was a character for sure before doing all of the reading for this episode. So she was just another villainess. She's like one of two who claim to then have a son of Namor, I think, because isn't there the other lady who clones him as well? It's a,
We'll get there. We'll get there.
yeah, it's a whole, but there's like another one too. But so I was like, I knew that she existed, but reading this, she is as a lot of my British friends say, a little bit of me. Like this is a little, she is fantastic. I love how ridiculously over the top she is. She is one of those villainesses that's like evil to be evil and will do whatever it takes to just be evil and be the thorn in someone's side, and I'm here for it.
I love this messy character. Back when I worked on the handbooks, my listeners know I was well known as the X-Men guy, the Daredevil guy, and the Defenders guy. But one of the subcategories that I would often delve into is the Submariner. I particularly love the 1970s Submariner run. I famously hate the 1940s Submariner stories, which are so awfully racist. And then the 90s Namor, when we get to John Byrne, it picks up on a lot of stuff, but it lacks a lot of the fun unless you get the right writer on it. Glenn, you and Jeff on Namor, I could read all day long. It's so deliciously
Right.
funny. Okay, we gotta jump into crazy continuity for just a minute before we introduce this character. Namor the Submariner was created by Bill Everett back as the first character of Marvel, basically in 1939. He's kind of the man from another world. He's a little bit Spock-like. He's the white guy in the undersea race of blue people. He's got a real triangular forehead, giant eyebrows that would put Professor X's to shame, and he has little wings on his ankles, and he's truly a wild character. They bring him back in the Bronze Age, early on in the Fantastic Four. He's been living as a vagrant for years. They find him on the street. The Submariner gets his beard shaved off by the Human Torch's flames, and then he gets wet and he's like, wait, name of the Submariner. He's sometimes a bad guy, sometimes a good guy. Now, along the way in the 1940s and 50s, we got a lot of continuity about this guy that doesn't really match the modern age unless modern writers try to make it work. One of those, he has a cousin, because if you have a male hero, you need a female counterpart, right? Batgirl to Batman. So we have Namor and Namora, who is later brought back pretty famously in the Agents of Atlas in the early 2000s as a really fun character. Both of them are canonically mutants because they have a human parent and an Atlantean parent that has resulted in super strength and ankle wings. Sometimes the continuity says anytime a human fucks an Atlantean, that's what's going to happen, but that's not really how it works. Namora also has a famous story where where it's a huge retcon later by John Byrne, where she goes to someone because she and Namor are both unable to bear children. So she has a love of her life. She goes to a crazy scientist named Vera, not to be confused with Lyra. Vera's a little creepy blue guy who's this awful clone specialist. And he takes a clone of Namora and implants that clone into Namora's own body. And that's where Namorita comes from. She's a clone of Namora, but technically she's a mutant in the same way that like Laura Kinney would be a mutant, right? Namorita is introduced in the 1960s in a very Bye Bye Birdie fashion. I promise to do a trial of this character one day. And Namora is kind of written off to the legends until she comes back later. The reason we have to establish all of that is because all of this ties into the complicated storylines involving Lyra. Lyra is a different character who has a human parent and a Lemurian parent. Now, Lemuria is different from Atlantis. Glenn, do you want to give everybody the like one paragraph summary of Marvel Comics' origins of Undersea Atlantis? Since you're the guy that rose it to the surface that one time.
Basically, I mean, we discovered that Atlantis was a thing back in the World War II during, the Captain America era and everything. And the first time we hear about it is when he attacked a sub. I think it was because a sub was dropping bombs or something. It was dropping, torpedoes and things on Atlantis, and that's the first time we hear about it. So yeah, it's been around in the Marvel Universe for a long, long time, longer
Yeah,
than Wakanda.
but the retconned history is like back to the like Hyborian era of like ancient humanity. There's a continent that sunk beneath the waves and like evolved differently. So these are like previous humans. They have their own set of gods. But Atlantis has hundreds of appearances and a history that stretches back hundreds of years. It's also tied to the Deviants. And this is where we have to take another quick continuity dive. We have the Deviant capital of Lemuria, which is also tied to ancient times. But it's separate and distinct from the undersea kingdom of Lemuria, where in Atlantis they have blue skin, in Lemuria undersea they have more green skin. And in the deviant Lemuria is where like everybody's a crazy genetic bomb of like whatever mutation going off. And that's where Ghaur comes from, Ghaur. That's the warlord priest that is tied to the Eternals and the Deviants storylines. So we have Lemuria and Lemuria. We have mutant hybrids, including Lyra, which we'll talk about. And then we have the crazy chronology of the sterile Namor and Namora and Namorita that all tie into this character's history. And I did that as succinctly as I could. Did I do good?
Wow. Wow, that's fantastic. I couldn't have done it any better. You must have written the Marvel Universe handbook.
I sure did. So, Glenn, let's take us back to the 1990s when you are put on this book. We shared that story a little bit on the main show. My question for you here more specifically is, how did you delve into researching the world of Namor the Submariner? And what like storylines, I know this is a long time later, so whatever shows up here is great. But what storylines or villains or super foes like really showed up as like the favorites that you really wanted to use?
Oh, well, the favorites, I always loved Tiger Shark. I loved, the way his relationship with his sister and everything, and who was, then the wife of Stingray, and also, just that whole dynamic there, how he was, cursed to be, living in the sea. And I always thought he was, a very misunderstood character. And I thought Bob Harris did a really good job of bringing that out. And so after I took over from Bob, I just wanted to extend that. But my history with Namor goes back to I was always a Hulk fan. I always say, I would get the reprints of Tales to Astonish, and it was in Marvel Superheroes, so it was the reprints of that and had the Hulk and Submariner, and I would just skip over the Submariner stories and just read the Hulk stories. So I had all these, comics in my collection, and then when I was told, Glenn, you're writing Namor, I mean, I did a proposal for Namor, but it was really, the editor was Mike Rockowitz at the time, and he said, hey, I need a plot on my desk by Friday. I said, oh, well, don't you want the proposal? He goes, no, I need the plot. Oh, all right. So I got him the plot, and then after that, I got him the synopses for the rest of the series. And the first one, I think we discussed this the last time, but the first comic I did was the Rime of the Ancient Submariner, because I was just pressed. I just needed some time to collect my thoughts. And I am heavily a a big researcher. I love researching Herod. I love doing that. Hence why I also, Chad, wrote the Marvel Universe Handbook, and I love doing that stuff. But I didn't want to go in there and half-ass it, you know. So that's why I started off. I just do this story. This it takes place in the future, you know, the rhyme of the ancient Submariner. You know, I'll be some. At least I'll have a month to then catch up and get my research. We had had the Saga of the Submariner was done back then. That was, you
Which
know,
even
it
now
was a
is a
12 issue.
brilliant read. 12-issue series that covers Namor. And in the modern days, literally, we're recording this in mid-March, just last Wednesday, like 48 hours ago, the new Namor series, which is an 8-issue series by Jason Aaron, just wrapped up, which is also retelling Namor's origins.
Oh, so here we go again. But yes, but that was a big help doing that. But I, you know, went into a lot of those stories that I had that, you know, that the Marvel superheroes. And so I was reading those and, you know, caught on a lot of things. Like, wow, I missed a lot of this character. I really missed, you know, when I was skipping over those tales, I was like, this is a lot of fun. So I was glad that I had those there and was able to look at those. And then when I came in, I had a lot of continuity, not a lot of continuity, a lot of plot of things to when John Byrne had, he left a lot of things to be developed, right? You know, there were a lot of the, you know, storylines and a plot, you know, things that threads that he just left hanging there. So I had to go in there and I had to resolve some of those because Bob Harris, when he did his Undersea Epic, he didn't even address any of that. So all right, so I had to go in there. There's just all these things. I said, I can't go in there and not resolve this. So I went in and when I had the whole Phoebe Mars thing and when Phoebe Mars appeared and was appearing to her brother and or no, Desmond was appearing to Phoebe, excuse me, and you know, he was already dead. There was a lot, you know, who was this guy? Why was she seeing his ghost? What was going on? So I had to resolve this. And when I looked at the one character who could be behind this, it was a stretch, but who could be behind this was Lyra.
We're going to talk all about Lyra and we'll get into the crazy Submariner continuity, but I just want to tell you what a fun, wild, campy journey this is. Demanda, I feel like I could do 8 different episodes on Namor specific characters with you, beginning with Namorita, because we would have a fucking good time every time. His favorite rogue, my favorite rogues of his are Tiger Shark. Atuma is amazing. I'm not a big Warlord Krang and Beera guy, but fucking Dr. Dorcas can get it. He's so fun. Like there's some really delightful villains in this rogues gallery.
So I love Namorita because I was a big New Warriors fan in the early 90s when I like first got into comics, because I got into comics through the trading cards. And so one of the cards that I got was Firestar, and I was like, oh, who's this? What team is she on? Let me, read an issue. And Namorita was cool because she was kind of like the hard-nosed warrior kind of in that book. I recently did a Namorita look based on her 90s appearance, which was awesome because reading back on her history, she was like this love drunk kid in like the 60s and 70s being like, oh, cousin Namor is like so hot, and it's like, girl, that's your cousin.
He's wonderful. I do a monthly trial on my show. Namorita is near the top of my list. Like I will make that happen sometime relatively soon. It's a long list, but she's close. I love her, and it's the perfect time because we're doing all these 70s chicks, right? We're doing like Hellcat and Moondragon, like in the next quarter on my show, which is delightful. Okay, we're gonna
Amanda,
jump in.
have you done Firestar?
Have I done Firestar?
Yeah.
As a
Yes, I
drag
have.
look?
Yes, I have. I did like her classic look, the yellow, and but I added the Luciano Vecchio red zipper up top because I thought that looked cute.
All right.
So originally, my friend who did the mask for me, he did it like really narrow on my face, kind of like what she usually does. And I was like, no, I need like the big 90s nonsense on my face. I want to be able to like hit people when I turn my head. So he made me a second one that was much bigger. Yes, I do love Firestar. And also, as of this recording, can't remember her last name, but Sadie, the redhead actress from Stranger Things, has been rumored to be eyed for a new role in the Spider-Man movie. And I'm like, please be Angelica Jinks. Please be Angelica Jinks.
Watch, it'll be Lyra.
Well, I've got a little sidebar to that that I can add. So when I first started at Marvel, I was, hope you don't mind me taking us off a little side path here, Chad, but when
That's
I
my
first
favorite
started,
thing, please.
Tom DeFalco, I was an associate editor at the time, so I just sat outside his desk and I sent out a lot of FedEx packages. But one of the things he asked me, some woman came out, he said, Glenn, this is Kathy, can you just give her a tour of Marvel? I'm like, sure thing, Tom. So I'm, you know, walking walking her around and everything. And then at one point I said, "So why do you get a special tour? Who are you?" She goes, "Oh, well, I'm the voice of Firestar in Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends." I was like, "Oh my God, that's so cool. That's amazing." So, I was like, "This is fantastic." And I'm, walking around with everything. And I said, "Let me hear your Angelica voice first." And she gives me the Angelica. And then I said, "Now let me hear your Firestar voice." And she goes deeper and more heroic and everything. And so as I'm walking around, I said, "Is there anything else I might know you from? Is there anything?" She goes, "Oh no, this is probably long before your time. But I was in this show called Family Affair." And I was like, "You're Sissy. You're Sissy from Family Affair." And she was like, "You know it?" I'm like, "Oh my God." I was introducing her to the bullpen. People knew her. It's like, "You're Sissy. Oh my God." And she was in hysterics. She loved it. So.
I love that story. You better believe I have things to say about Firestar, but my show's trapped in 1975 at present. We're not going to get to Angelica for a minute. Amanda, do you want to talk to us about Lyra's classic look? We first meet her in 1970 in Submariner 32, and she is Ursula underwater.
She really is.
I mean, Ursula's underwater too.
So again, she's also again very drag queen, which again, pardon me, for a lot of us entertainers, like it's the big loud personalities that we always want to emulate, and like Lyra definitely has that, and I think the loud personality plus the really loud look. So she has like the greeny olive skin, like the green spiky hair, and you can't really tell, like, is it spiky because we're underwater and it's like moving, which is again very Ursula, but it's a little bit longer than Ursula's. But it's
It's
like
kind of
the
Bride of Frankenstein.
a little bit of that too. And she's wearing like the like classic like leotard bodysuit, but it has like a high collar, which, oh, I love a high collar. Like it's just dramatic. So like you know that she's gonna have like something to do and something to say. The thigh high boots, classic. She has like a corsety belt thing that has some like details on it that's gold. So she has like
It's giving like
everything.
a, it's giving like heavyweight boxing champion belt.
Yes. And of course she's got like the big chunky gold jewelry. Like she is drag queen. Like that is drag queen, cosplay drag. Like I would it again if I didn't already have, all of my looks planned from now until the end of August, I would be like, "Oh, we're taking this to FlameCon. Like we're walking around as a, green lady and with a red high collar, but another day, another day."
This is a woman who has to swim from place to place, who puts on thigh-high boots and like the biggest fucking cape that must weigh 120 pounds
L
underwater. Like
l listen.
she made choices for fashion.
Listen, as Miss Piggy taught me in Great Muppet Keeper, sometimes you just need to put on your swimming gloves.
That's
Like
very, very true.
you just need you need a good high heel to kick that water a little faster.
Glenn,
Yes.
it's 1970. Roy Thomas and Selby Shema have created Lyra. Who's the actress that would be her voice? What does she sound like? Does she sound like Sissy from A Family Affair?
No, absolutely not. No, it would definitely be a lot more, a lot deeper, a lot more resonant. I'm trying to think of a modern actress that would be someone
I
who would.
almost feel like she's got a baritone. It's almost like Madeline Kahn to me a little bit.
Yeah, that would be a good one.
Amanda, do
I
you
was
have an
trying to think something a little
opinion?
more modern, but yeah, Madeline Kahn would be good.
Amanda, do you have an opinion? Who does Lyra sound like?
I mean, unfortunately, in my brain, as soon as there's like an over-the-top female villainess, I immediately want to go for like a Mae West or the iconic Uma Thurman as Mae West as Poison Ivy kind of
Oh.
vibe. Like that's like the voice that you just hear in your head, because again, it's that super campy, like melodramatic dialogue.
Is
So
she Faye Dunaway as Joan Crawford?
I mean, probably a little bit of that too, like the n so not Faye Dunaway and Mommy Dearest, but like Faye Dunaway and Supergirl.
Sure. Okay. Well, Demanda's going to do some Lyra dialogue for us today. You get to pick whatever voice you choose. It is Submariner 32, 1970, created by Roy Thomas and Sabu Shema. The cover shows Lyra just kind of putting like something on display. She's like selling her wares. Namor is in a fish tank in an aquarium, and she's basically offering him to the public. Ladies and gentlemen, presenting our feature attraction is like what we get. The title box on the cover says, "Call her Lyra, call her Legend." And they are absolutely correct. So inside, we see Namor visiting the undersea kingdom of Lemuria for the first time in ages. It's a parallel of Atlantis. The humans here have a different kind of skin. It's more scaly and like a little bit more green. He finds they have a new leader. They are shouting, "Hail Lyra, Empress of all Lemuria!" And she enters carrying a staff that has like a fanged head. So we get Set energy right from the beginning. Remember Set, the snake god, for later on. And she's giving very Ursula energy, and she says,
You have done well, faithful godsmen. Long have I waited for this moment when the fabled Submariner should stand thus before me. You may go now. Namor and I shall continue this audience in private.
I know not who you may be, female, but I have no desire for audience with you in private or before a world assembled. Let me speak to the mighty Carthon, that's the former emperor, or to the man who has taken his place, that's the head of Lemurian nation.
Like all males, Prince Namor, you assume too much, or else you would not have asked to see the man who has replaced him. Still, you shall be granted the first part of your request. Look now upon mighty Carthon, and I speak to him if you have a mind to. Much good shall it do you both.
But when light turns on, Namor sees Carthon chained and surrounded by sharks. She married this guy to take over the empire and then like left him in a trap, basically. And if Namor doesn't back off, Lyra's like, "I'll make the sharks command," because she can control wildlife with her mind, which is a skill we see Namor do sometimes, but Lyra does it way better. Like, this is her top skill set, is calling crazy like undersea creatures to do her bidding. She also gets to monologue about her origins. And Demand and I are gonna go back and forth as we summarize this because it's a long one. But this is a crazy fucking story. And this is a mutant character I want you to remember. Demand, go ahead.
It begins 2 decades ago with a beautiful girl and a vessel off the coast of sun-splashed Hawaii.
Okay, rewind about 40 years. Namor is the result of an American fisherman meeting an Atlantean princess. This is a variation of that story, but it gets twisted around a few times, so you just gotta follow with us. We see a woman who's fishing for a prize exhibit to try to save her oceanarium, but they catch a man with blue scales in the net, and he's only wearing red briefs.
His name is, so I'm assuming Lyron, if we're doing
Lyron or Liron? I call
Lyron.
him Liron. I call him
Lyron.
Yeddi. Yes.
Lyron. His name was Lyron from the lost city of Lemuria, and he had been hurt when he was landed.
And soon they are swimming and frolicking together.
They speedily became far more than friends. However, and soon during one of their short intervals that Lyron could exist out of water, they were married. The minister, a friend of the girl's father, vowed in secrecy on the ceremony. Though few knew of the reason why, the small oceanarium prospered after that day as more and rarer sea beasts were captured.
So she married
Then.
an undersea man and then just started collecting fucking rare animals and putting them on display, we suppose.
I mean, work. Listen, again, a girl's gotta eat and a girl's gotta do fishing. Like,
Don't know if that would
then
be
one
allowed so
day.
much nowadays, but.
Yeah, no, I don't think so either.
Then one day, an attendant was careless. A girl was in the tank, and Lyron fought bravely, desperately to protect her. Two people of two wildly different worlds had entered the tank that day, but only one came out again.
Amanda, you're gonna need a lozenge. We see like some giant sharks have been captured and they like completely consume Liren. So like the father, the guy, the undersea guy, is dead at this point.
I love that again in your notes, it just says, we see one of the giant sharks had completely consumed him.
And she
Like,
continues.
wild. Yet, of that fleeting union, twin baby girls were born.
I'll call you Lori and you Lyra after your father. Okay, so Lori and Lyra, twin baby girls, the union of a Lemurian man with a woman who owns an oceanarium.
In Hawaii.
Yes, in Hawaii.
Yes, Namor, I was one of those children fated after my gills developed at the age of 6 months to dwell forever underwater. Long have I loathed this existence, for no man beneath the sea, not even Carthon, could hope to be equal to my power. None save you, Namor.
Okay, so the origin is twins were born, one of them develops gills and like has to live in a tank. That's what we're told. So that's Lyra, the other one is Laura. Okay, so Lyra puts a hand on Namor's face. She's all flirty flirty, like, "You're so hot, oh my God," she loves him.
I love that she's like all angry and then immediately switches gears to be like, but I still want to fuck. Like, it's like immediate.
We all have
What?
slept with someone like this, all of us.
What say you, Atlantean? Shall we join forces, you and I, to conquer land and sea alike?
The tale of your birth is not unlike my own, Lyra, and you remind me of myself when I was young and ambitious and cruel. But now my one desire is for peace with honor, and there is no room for conquest in my life. And he pushes her hand away.
So that is your answer. Then I shall grind you beneath my heel, even as I did noble Carthon.
And she literally summons electric eel monsters, which is very Ursula, to knock Namor out.
Well done, my pets. All men must learn that it is folly to defy Lyra of Lemuria.
Namor wakes up in a cage inside the Oceanarium, where the twin, Lori, who's the white version of Lyra, like the Caucasian version, is keeping him on display with chemicals that keep him unable to break through the glass. So Namor ends up breaking free with the help of Lori and Lyra's mother, who is named Rhonda. Rhonda Morris is her name. So Rhonda helps get Namor out, but Lyra is waiting, and she's under the sea, and she summons a hammerhead, an octopus, some fanged fish, a sperm whale, and she's like, fucking get him! And Namor has to like fight the whale. He knocks out Lyra, maybe kills her. He takes her to the surface to bury her. And when he gets her up into the oxygen, she changes form into Lori. They're not twins, or they are. So, Glenn, this is my first huge question for you. Are Lyra and Lori two people living in the same body, or are Lyra and Lori the same person, but it's like a mental illness, like a multiple personality switch? When she's on this land, it's one, and when she's under the ocean, it's the other. I don't know if it's ever quite been explained.
I don't think it's been explained either. And I was actually going to do a story with that where actually they were two different people. And then she assumed the identity of Lori after Lori died. That was a story that I had planned, a few months after I left the book. But that's one thing I wanted to do with the series was take, whatever happened to Lori. So.
But one of her mutant powers, Lyra, we learn, is that she can shift her hair color and her skin color. She's not a traditional shapeshifter, although she does seem to be able to alter her hair, like the length and things. There's like a low-level power. So I don't know if she's pretending. I don't know if she's crazy. I don't know if this is actually her twin and like it lives inside her. It's like Professor X and Cassandra Nova sharing a body somehow.
Right. But
Yes, exactly.
I wonder if her powers are kind of like an octopus where they can like fully shift everything around them, but you can still tell it's an octopus, like if that makes sense. Like they're like th they can like move all of their like they can change like every color and like the
Yeah, like
shape
a
of things.
cuttlefish, yeah.
So it's an interesting power to give a sea person because like it's like oh it still kind of makes sense for it. I also watched the entire Disney documentary about octopuses and they are insane, by
They're
the way.
amazing. Yeah.
They're also
So
fully alien. Like,
at the
they're
end
not
of
just
that first
person.
appearance, Lyra is dead, which we assume means Carthon is back in control of Lemuria. We never quite see that followed up on, although we've been to Lemuria a lot of times. I don't think Carthon has ever appeared again. But it's a couple issues later. Lyra still does not, this is not a woman you say no to. This is the lady that will stalk you and murder your family. If you're married, she'll kill your wife so that she can marry you. So it's the wedding of Namor the Submariner to the Lady Dorma, who is a character I'm enormously fond of. Glenn, are you a Lady Dorma fan?
Oh, I love Lady Dorma. Yes. I wish that she had stuck around, but as we are about to see, that does not happen.
It
So.
sure doesn't. So it is the announced wedding. It's very Little Mermaid. They're very excited about all of this. But we return to the Morris Oceanarium in Hawaii, where Rhonda Morris is keeping Lyra in a water tank, remembering how she used to dive down to get sunken treasures for her mom in order to make her wealthy. Also, it turns out they have two oceanariums, one in Hawaii and one in Florida. So this family's doing fine, pilfering the, riches of the undersea environment. So now we are in Florida, and Rhonda has spent all of her money on a machine that is going to reawaken dormant sea creatures, and she can use it to reanimate Lyra. This is bizarre science, you guys. So at the wedding ceremony, Lyra poses as Dorma. This is her first time using her power to pose as someone to try to fuck Namor. We're gonna remember this for a minute later. And she marries Namor, in Dorma's form. But when he kisses his wife, he's like, wait a minute, that's not how Dorma kisses. And she says,
The woman whom you are forever married, whose bonds to you can never be broken, is Lyra, late the Empress of far-off Lemuria, and now Queen of all Atlantis.
this is literally Ursula's plot. So, in the next issue,
Yes.
it turns out Lyra had some Lemurians kidnap and hide Dorma in a secret place. And Lyra's going to kill Dorma unless Namor is like, yes, you're my queen, and yes, you control Atlantis. But he says, never, not in a thousand lifetimes shall I submit to base blackmail.
Then it is you who have truly doomed your love, not I.
And Namor chases Lyra around, grabs her by the hair, and is like, look, I don't hit women, but now I shall hit my wife. And the god Proteus actually says the marriage is invalid. Like, the undersea god is like, yeah, she's posing as someone else. The god calls Lyra an ambitious shrew, and she swims off, like, covers her escape with a bunch of sea creatures, and then goes back to where she's keeping Dorma in a tank in the Florida Oceanarium. So the henchmen call over the intercom, calling Lyra, calling Lyra. Namor is attacking, and he jumps in, and he calls her a black-hearted harpy. And Lyra has a cute little breathing helmet on, and Namor beats up her guards, and she's like, "Oh no, he's beating me faster than I was ready." But she's ready for a big dramatic finale. So he fights off a giant crab. Lyra shatters the glass, and Dorma comes like spilling out and is now choking on oxygen and can't breathe. Lyra taunts her as this woman is dying, like choking to death in front of her. She says,
Ignorant sea cow, don't you realize it was my plan all along that you two, who love each other in so maudlin a fashion, should perish at the same time? And in the best traditions of melodrama, you, a child of the oceans, gasping your last in the open air, and he, who is equally a creature of the land, falling beneath the onslaught of a very special foe, die silently, my dear, while I use my mental powers to summon my leeches!
and horrifically, tens of thousands of leeches cover Namor's body. It's truly horrifying. And Dorma, with her dying gasp, punches Lyra in the back of the head. The leeches float away because she's lost her control, and Dorma's just about to perish. Namor rushes in, scoops up Dorma's body, and her last words to him, I must try to speak, to say I love you one last time before. And Namor walks out with his lady love in his hands. His shadow, it's this really beautiful image. His shadow runs like really extra long, conveying like the weight of the moment. He steps into the ocean, Dorma! And he tells himself, you have been proud, Namor, haughty lord of an ancient land, and there are those who will swear that you never truly loved the girl you hold in your arms because you seldom held her close or called her endearing names. But those scoffing ones do not stand this night upon a foam-flecked rocky beach or hear you cry out to the mocking, ghost-haunted wind. If they did, then perhaps they would understand. Perhaps. You guys, this is insane. 1973 is when Gwen Stacy dies. This is before that. We have a love interest of a major superhero dying in his arms, murdered by this crazy fucking woman.
And Namor has a much more robust love life than Peter Parker ever did, right? So, like, he's had a lot of different, loves throughout his life, but this was his first true love. Dormer was the one that was going to be, she was going to be his queen. And I love that ending where, where it was saying, he was never allowed to show that emotion to her in public because he had to be that regal being and could never be. But, deep down, he loved her more than anything and anybody. He has loved her probably more than anyone ever since, really.
I can't remember her name. Oh, no, I do. So I used to read all the Nancy Drew and Hardy Boys books, like back when they were originally out. And in the early 90s, they like rebranded the books, like under, they were trying to make them a little more grown up. Like the continuity mattered. And in the very first book, I think it was Joe's girlfriend, Iola, dies. And I was like, oh, like they killed this major character. And it was so stunning. For anyone who reads the Hardy Boys books, you know what I'm talking about. But this is a crazy moment. Like, this is a moment where kids pick up this book and there's like a death. Demanda, what are your thoughts on this? From one ignorant sea cow to another.
Chad, you're the worst. I love you.
I love
But so, like, does it count as fridging if she gets killed by a woman? Because, like, I mean, honestly and truly, like, she's dying to serve Namor's character arc, obviously. Like, it's to then, like, move his story forward and have him grieve for a while and then, you know, kind of move on and all of that stuff. But so I'm like, I don't know if it's, like, truly fridging, but it's also, like, it's also around, it is sort of, like, around the time when this does become a bit of a popular trope. Because, like, another famous, well, I guess it may maybe, like, 10 years later. So, like, in the mid 80s is when Black Canary gets captured by like all of these rogues, and it's heavily implied that she is sexually assaulted numerous times by these people. And anyway, so it's so like it's like as someone who used to read Gail Simone's original Women in Refrigerators blog 100 years ago when the internet was new, yeah, like this definitely sort of has that air about it. But again, killed by a rival love interest, granted unrequited, he definitely does not want to have a relationship with with Lyra, but it's at least an interesting twist on a like hard trope.
And what have we learned about Lyra's psychology in this first appearance, our first set of appearances, Glenn?
Oh, she's a nut job. She's just a total fucking nut job. And she might be bipolar or whatever, you know, or probably split personality. And who knows if even Lori is still existing somewhere in there. We don't know. And, you know, and when we saw Lori for the first time, Lori was just as evil as her, right? She wasn't the, so, you know, if you have these two evil beings living inside you, oh my God, there's no hope for you.
Yeah, I love that she's just, I mean, it's truly evil, but she's like just Machiavellian, like calling Dorma names as she chokes to death, basically.
Oh,
This is a crazy powerful female villain on the likes of like on the same par as like Madame Hydra. Like I think she has a really strong, and like this is an era where women get to be evil, and she's one of the really evil ones.
and like she's literally like, and choke on it. Like she literally like said that. She's like, and again brings in, like, in all of the melodrama and whatever. She's like, oh no, I planned all of
I'm gonna
and
watch
like.
you die, and then I'm gonna sleep with your husband, and then I'm gonna like ravage your city for every resource I can get out of
Right,
it. Like
right.
it's gonna be delicious. So she comes back a little while later. It's about a year later in the comics where she's teamed up with Tiger Shark. Tiger Shark is an Olympic swimmer named Todd Arliss who got injured, and then an evil scientist bonded him with an actual tiger shark. So now he's like crazy shark-like all the time. He's got a lot of really fun stories. So they're teaming up. It is not a good combination. Tiger Shark keeps calling her like a wench, and his little buddy Limon is here. That's the worst name in comics, maybe. Limondo is a terrible name. And basically, the Human Torch gets involved. Lyra summons some monsters. But at the end of this story, Tiger Shark murders Namor's dad. Leonard Mackenzie dies at the hands of Tiger Shark. So Namor, in a year, has lost his bride and his father. We then jump to Submariner 50, and this is again early 70s, where Lyra is back once again. And this time, she's teamed up with Namor's like evil cousin Deera, who's like a guy with a blonde beard. He's got blue skin. He's fine. He's the shitty kid that wants to like rule the country. You know, see, you see this character in all the like gladiator movies,
Well,
right?
I was gonna say he's also what was it, Ocean Master and the Aquaman series, like his
Yeah.
like the evil
Yes. Uh-huh.
brother.
Aquaman. That's a whole tangent we don't have time for today. So she wants revenge, and Namor in this story, this is where he learns he has a little cousin named Namorita, and she is present, and Lyra is like delighting in this revelation. Namorita points out to Namor in one place, like, look behind you, Namor. Like, Lyra is back, basically. And Lyra gives us this juicy dialogue.
Yes, take a look, gallant prince. It may be your last. Tis true, we've not met for many moons or tides, if you will, but we parted with a vengeance. Yet I doubt not that you will yet remember.
You! My eyes deceive me. It's but a dream. Nay, no dream at all. Murderous slayer of my beloved Lady Dorma. Accessory to my Earth father's death. I remember.
Understandably, ignominious?
Ignominious.
Ignominious. What thesaurus does this woman have in the ocean? The ignominious one. No one forgets Lyra, late the lamented Empress of Lemuria, nor does she forget the spurning of her chosen betrothed. You scurrilous?
Sea scum.
Scurrilous sea scum.
Scurrilous sea scum sells seashells
Listen.
by the seashore.
This woman may be evil, but she definitely got like a 1600 on her SATs.
Yeah, and
Like,
she literally uses the old phrase, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. And Namor's like, you would compound the felony, woman? Kill me then and be done. And she has a gun and fires it. And she's like, I have enough power to be able to do this. Namor is like, hatred is sweet to savor, callous witch, and it fortifies every fiber of my being. I really hate Namor speaking Shakespearean. You killed the only thing I've ever loved, and for that you shall die. And he swims right into her, and the gun scatters. And there is like Namor just dumps her in the mud and like swims away. Like it's a weird resolution. In 51, we start to see Namorita flashing back to her own childhood. This is where we get the Namora tie-in. Namora, after the World War II, went to live with the Lemurians, and she like ended up fighting with Lyra a bunch, which makes Lyra like 15 years older than we originally thought. And there's like deeper connections to Lemuria than we thought as well. And they both like want the throne, but the heir to the throne is a guy named Murro, Merro. So Lyra ends up poisoning Namora, who like enters like a living death coma for like 40 years or something after this. She doesn't revive until the Agents of Atlas. And then Lyra marries Merro, and she poisons Merro, and then she allies with Beera and makes plans to conquer Atlantis with him. And then she promises to be Beera's consort one day. And so Namorita ends up getting raised by Lyra and Beera. First of all, Lyra and Beera is a terrible couple's name, and they're raising Namorita as their own. And now we have this new plot against Namor, and they like show him Namora's corpse. She's like, okay, I murdered your fiance, but do you remember a few years back? I actually murdered your cousin too. I bet you were wondering what happened to her. Crazy retcon. Glenn, what are your thoughts on this kind of deepening lore for Lyra in Undersea World?
Well, again, it's just one of those things where she's killing every woman who ever meant anything to Namor. So, you see these things where, he's just dumping her, off. Like, I'm surprised he did not make sure that she was dead at the end of every single confrontation she has with this psycho, right? But, I did the same thing. He actually left her alone again in one of the stories that I wrote. So,
It's really shockingly violent where it all ends for each of these stories. Like, she's murdered a lot of people that he cares about. Demanda, do you have thoughts?
I wonder if because of the times that it was written that it was like, well, we can't have Namor like killing a woman like on panel. And also, I mean, it is the sort of serialized storytelling of comics where, again, there you should always leave it a little open-ended in case someone wants to go back and use this character again, or they have plans down the road or something. So like it makes sense, but like in real life, like that Namor definitely would have like ripped her face off.
Both Dorma and Gwen Stacy's deaths are really resonant, right? Like Dorma could have been saved under the right circumstances. And when Spider-Man shoots that web and Gwen's off the bridge and her neck pops, you know what I mean? Like they're both really sad and kind of akin to each other.
And also, like, they really haven't like come back officially. Like, there's been alternate universes and and stuff like that, but they're also like deaths because they really mattered, haven't really been undone, which
Yeah,
is.
Dorma was one of the exiles for a while, with like an alternate Dorma, which is crazy. So, Amazing Spider-Man 213 through 215 is where we next see Lyra. She uses an octopus to break the wizard out of prison. We're not talking about the wizard today, but this is a crazy character too. And Lyra watches amused as the wizard goes after Spider-Man, and they recruit Sandman and the Trapster into the new Frightful Four. Okay, pause. My listeners will know I've shared this before. The reason I ended up getting recruited to the handbooks is I used to write Survivor fan fiction online starring Marvel characters. My first two seasons were about the Masters of Evil. My third season was about the Serpent Society, and my fourth season was called The Sinister Six versus the Frightful Four, and Lyra was one of my cast members, so I got to research her and like write her in this like fan fictional series and then later write her in the handbooks, which was a lot of fun. Anyway, so they lure Namor into a fight with Spider-Man, but Lyra also poses like a sexy new neighbor in like skimpy clothes and is like flirting with Peter Parker. She's breathing oxygen again, which maybe that happens when she turns Caucasian, I don't know. So she knows his real identity somehow. In the end, Spidey and Namor end up getting their powers swapped, and Lyra pulls a knife on Spidey, and Namor just knocks her out in one punch. But again, she is left alive at the end of this story. I summarized that really quickly. It's a fun read.
Well, I was I think I was editing or the assistant editor on those at that time.
Oh,
So
that's
yeah,
crazy.
definitely did.
Do you have any memories of that story?
Well, that was all in the during the whole was that the Serpent Crown or was that the Atlantis
Well,
Attacks one?
Serpent
Or was
Crown is
that
next.
the Serpent Crown's next? Okay, so this one, yeah, it was geez, wow, I
Yeah,
do
no,
not
truly, no worries.
remember that very well. No, I do not.
So let's jump to the Serpent Crown, and this is where X-Men fans will know a little bit more. Some of the early Namor stories. Namor is like catatonic for years, right? He's like living as a homeless man, and there's a Marvel character character named Paul Destin, or Destiny, who's like a man dressed in shorts and a funny hat. That's his whole costume. And he used his little fancy telepathic hat to like wipe Namor's memories. That hat turns out to be the Serpent Crown, which then gets pulled into the rocks and stuff. We'll be touching on that later when we get to the Avengers script readings, because Beast is part of that story in the early Avengers. Anyway, fast forward. The Serpent Crown is connected to the Elder God Set, S-E-T, who's a giant snake god that's like, think very Lovecrafty, right? He wants to come to Earth and he has seven heads and he needs seven brides, basically. So Gar, who's the warlord priest of Deviant Lemuria, he's back and he has plans and he's teaming up with Lyra from regular Lemuria. And the two of them go on a quest to do a whole bunch of things across a line of Marvel books called Marvel Annuals. And it's a storyline called Atlantis Attacks. And many people have read it. It has been collected a lot of times. There's funny side stories. Lyra is only tangentially part of some of the stories, but it results in the Seven Brides of Set storyline, where like Scarlet Witch and Storm and other characters get like, or Jean Grey gets selected to be the gods or the wives of this like snake head. Demanda, are you a fan of Atlantis Attacks?
So I only know it from reading like synopses of the Atlantis Attack storyline as like again like tangentially X-Men. So I have read most of my quote unquote comics, like my comic knowledge comes from uncannyxmen.net. So I've read a lot of these issues like in synopsis form. And this is one of them because again, like Jean and Scarlet Witch, like they all get chosen to be one of the and it's kind of like this where it's just like they were chosen to be Seven Brides of Set. Stuff happens. Magicy magic, it all ends up okay.
And do you remember what? So, I mean, they were always looking for ways to theme the annuals in the summer at this time, but do you remember how
Right.
Atlantis Attacks comes about?
This was in the beginning when we were trying to come up with, different themes for the annuals for, every year. And I remember when this was proposed, and I was not a big fan of it at the time. I was like, how often are these guys going to get their asses kicked when they come out there with their fish bowls on their head? It's kind of like, Killer Clowns from Outer Space. You just got to bop them in the nose and they explode. And the same thing with, these fishbowl guys. Just crack them in the head. They can't breathe anymore. Why do they want the surface world? What are they going to do with it when they're there? I never quite understood that whole logic. So.
So my favorite annual is the New Mutants one because there's that Proteus horn that summons the sea monsters and the kids get to fight. That's really fun. Lyra is basically involved in the plot of this, and she and Gar are like kind of scheming on each other, but they're planning to take over the world. Her most prominent appearance in this run is an Amazing Spider-Man annual 23, and she gets to say things like "Hail Set." She makes a deal with the gay Roman Emperor Tyrannus from Subterranea, who is another character that's so much I would love to talk about more sometime. But he's trapped in the body of the Abomination. Truly, don't worry about it. It's a crazy thing. They end up turning him back into his human form, and when he pops out in these like little tiny tight white panties, like it's truly hilarious. Tyrannus is a funny character. She also gets to visit Magneto's like Bermuda Triangle Island in one issue, which is kind of fun. And in the end, of course, they get their asses kicked. In Fantastic Four Annual 22, which results in the end of the storyline, Lyra gets a big power boost by Set because he has joined the Seven Brides and or with the Seven Brides, and she's prepared to sacrifice her entire army. She fights Namor directly. Like, she's up in power and able to fight him. And she tries to trick him into killing Namorita, but he ends up with his hands around her throat. And when the Serpent Crown disappears, she does as well. And that brings us up to Namor in the 90s, which is most of Lyra's appearances. Glenn, do you have any thoughts on her early history before we jump into some of your work with her?
Many supplements on the market are hard to absorb or packed with fillers, but that's not the case with Quiksilver Scientific. Quiksilver Scientific is a U.S.-based company that manufactures advanced liposomal supplements, making nutrients easier for your body to absorb and put to work quickly. Made in Colorado in an NSF GMP certified facility and rigorously tested, this is science-first supplementation. After adding Ultravitamin into my routine, recovery feels faster and I don't hit that midday crash anymore. Trusted worldwide for supplements that truly make a difference in performance, resilience, and well-being. Quiksilver Scientific makes advanced liposomal supplements so you can actually feel the difference. Energy, focus, calm, recovery. Get 10% off plus free shipping at tryqs.com/podcast. That's tryqs.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
that I do my research meticulously, so I really wanted to make sure that I understood the character before I brought her in, and I really needed to resolve some of the plot threads that Byrne had left. So when I was, and I wanted to really just bring that someone classic, and I said, you know what, this makes sense. And yeah, did I extend her shape-shifting abilities maybe a bit? I did, but she was also able to mimic Dorma, right? So she, her shape-shifting abilities was more than just her skin and her hair. She was able to like convince, Namor that it was, that was his bride to be until they kissed. So I thought, hey, how, where can I bring this in? What is her motive? Well, her motive is pretty much the same as it always was, right? She wants the thrones of both Atlantis and Lemuria. She wants to bring them together. And then I had the whole Vera thing on top of it. So I got to bring them all together. I had to bring all these plot points that Byrne had left just dangling there, which he did a lot. And I had to bring them all into and try to resolve them all. And I,
Byrne's crazy in this
complex.
run because he'll spend like 14 issues exploring one tiny subplot that could have been done in 2 pages, but then he'll completely ignore other things. But this is Namor trying to be an environmentalist. And this is one of the odd theories Byrne produces for Namor is he's like sometimes a good guy, sometimes a bad guy, basically because of oxygen deprivation. Like if he's too long on the land or in the sea, also he's sterile, but later another writer, like he fathers a child. Anyway, it's inconsistent. But I think Lyra, I think for everything we know about her, there's three things we don't. Like she is shady with her origins, she is shady with her powers. You can amp up those shape-shifting powers all you want, because we don't know what her deal is.
And in her appearance right before this, she gets like the power boost from
The
Set.
Serpent
So,
Crown.
it works.
There you go, Demanda. That's what happened. There you go. You get a no prize,
Yes, no prize.
Demanda.
I keep my little collection of no
So
prizes.
Namor is running Oracle Incorporated, which is like an environmentalist agency. Although, Glenn, you kind of phased that part of his story out a little bit, which is appropriate, I think. That part of him, Namor in the business suit, only worked for a minute for me in some ways. Phoebe Mars is like a very 90, early 90s, like power boss bitch, like spiky crew cut hair and like short skirt. And that's who Lyra poses as in order to fuck Namor's nephew, Leon McKenzie, who's a shitty supervillain named the Black Marais. She gets pregnant as a result of this. And then what does she do, Glenn?
Then she goes to Namor and she poses as Sue Richards, who had just lost Reed at the time, and she was on a quest. She was the only person that didn't think Reed was dead. Everyone's like, "Oh, he's gone." And even Namor was like, "Come on, Sue, he's gone. Let's you and I go to it." And she's like, "No way, Namor, we're not gonna do it." But then Lyra takes over and becomes Sue, and then in a moment of weakness, seduces Namor at night, and then boom.
So Namor fucks Sue Richards, but it's really Lyra, which is a rape story. Like, we have to be clear, but also it's hilarious.
Well, there is a scene in there where where Sue where he where Sue learns what she did. She just kind of scoffs at it, like, come on, Namor, you're a playboy. So what? She fucked you, right? And he tells her, if it was done to you, it would be called something else, right? And so.
And this is a blind spot for me. It's come up on my show before. When it's a female getting raped, I have very strong feelings against. But when it's like a supervillainess doing it to a man, there's something that I find amusing, but that's totally like biased. And I'm a therapist, so we have odd biases that we discover sometimes. But this is funny. This is a chunky, chewy story. When she reveals who she really is, Demanda, do you want to give us her line?
Yes, Namor, we've finally consummated our marriage of so long ago.
This woman has been waiting for years to fuck this man. She doesn't even
Yes.
want him anymore, but she said she was gonna do it, and she fucking did it. She's so MILF here as well. Jeff Isherwood draws her like so juicy, like she's so juicy. It's there's a full page of her in this run where she's just like dripping with like cougar energy. It's so like Stifler's mom, like it's so
I love that for
it's
her. I
crazy.
do.
Do you remember getting that art back, Glenn? Because it's nuts.
I loved, I mean, anytime I got anything from Jeff, it was just wonderful, the script. And, so we, so we always did the Marvel method. So I would send plot, it would come back, and he would add things to it. It was like, oh, I can't wait to script this. I cannot wait to, dialogue this. And, hopefully my Lyra voice comes as cross as well as Demanda is doing it.
So Namor gets the FF involved. Elijah the Laser Fist is here. Anyway, there's a big fight, and Namor is gonna kill her, but she's like, "Remember how we fucked yesterday? Turns out I'm pregnant." So a few issues later, it's 53. Lyra goes to Vera, who's in the body of Dorma. Glenn, I'm gonna let you explain this to our listeners.
So the reason that so and he starts laughing at the end of that issue. Namor starts cracking up when she says, "I'm pregnant," based on you and I having sex, and then the Fantastic Four look at Namor like he's going nuts, he's going mad. But because he knows, no one else does, he knows that because he's a hybrid, he is sterile. And that's why he's like, "Yeah, you really you think that you've got my son inside you? You're screwier than I thought." And he just starts cracking up. So that's why, then later on she goes, that's why she needed to get his genetic material from his nearest living relative to impregnate her. And that's why then she goes to Vera and then wants to force grow the fetus into a full grown.
So Vera is like a little wild, like wiry, like genetic scientist who's like an outcast. He lives in like a cave all by himself and he has like some problems. And he has now created a cloned body of Dorma's to transfer his own mind into, which is kind of an odd like transgender story in a way. This man has like built the body that he wants. And so now Lyra wants to like, this is not a patient woman, nor does she want to be pregnant for 9 months, nor does she want to give birth. She's not interested in any of that. She
Yeah,
wants the benefits
no,
of
thank
motherhood, not the
you.
process.
Again, like, we have science now. I don't have to do this.
So he amps her up to like fully pregnant, and she says, "Better that than to suffer the indignity of looking like a bloated pufferfish for 9 months." Vera makes Lyra promise to take over Atlantis and build him a monument. And he says that he has copied Lyra's mind and put it into the fetus that is in her body, which is what he did with Nomura and Namorita, remember? So Lyra thinks that she's going to give birth to her son with her own mind. And there's something about this like woman in a man's world who she just wants that man's body so she can have the privilege and power that everyone else does. It's very, very interesting. So the baby is born. She names her kid Liren after her father, presumably. And the second he comes out of the tank, he's aged up to the age of 16. This is a 16-year-old. Demanda, describe this character for us.
I mean,
He's
16
so
in this,
beefcakey.
16 in the sense that the entire cast of Riverdale is 16. Like it is very 90210. It's very 16-year-old, but we still cast a 26-year-old so we can work full time. Like he is extremely beefy, but I do enjoy the fact that he has like bat wings on his ankles. But he's also green like his mother, just like a beefier version of Namor. But, I mean, also in the way that he's drawn, especially in like that very 90s style. I mean, he's hot again, just like a cast member of any teen WB soap.
He's like green, sexy Namor. He's like a little more
Yes.
muscly, a little more lean somehow. And it's the reptile wings. This is a crazy character that I think has a lot of potential. And Glenn, I think you had big plans for him, which is one of my questions for you in a moment. So once Liren comes out of the tank, Lyra swims over and murders Vera, like breaks his neck. And Lyra can sense it, or Vera can sense it coming, because here's the spoiler: Vera actually put his own mind into Liren's body. Lyra thinks it's her mind, and that would not have worked, by the way. Lyra versus Lyra in a man's body, she was not going to win that contest of wills, I don't think. But now Vera's mind is in that body. Okay, so Tiger Shark and a character named Tamara Ran, who is an alien red lady, you don't need to know more, have arrived. Liren and Lyra swim to the gates of Atlantis, and they're like, "It's Namor's son, and we shall now take over." And they fight Tiger Shark and Tamara to like defeat them and show their strength. Namor sees Liren for the first time, and of course, they get in a fist fight. We jump forward. Liren leads Atlantis to the United Nations, where he gives a speech for peace. And this is interesting because he's kind of doing that thing that Namor was never able to, which is fascinating. And Lyra is super pissed and summons like Gigantus, which is like the monster whale, to fight. She has the Horn of Proteus, which I love. Blow the horn and a monster appears. It's my favorite thing. And Namor bursts through the wall. There's a huge fight. Liren then kills Gigantos with one punch through the skull, which shows you what Namor is capable of. Like, he's doing that thing where, like, years later, Dan Slott gave us the story where Dr. Octopus took over Spider-Man's body and then he was a better Spider-Man than Spidey was. Liren's kind of doing that for Namor in a way here. But so we learn that Vera is in command of this body, and Liren is now in command of Atlantis. And the reason she finally realizes that Vera is in her mind, in her son's mind is Liren builds a statue of Vera, which is what Vera wanted her to do. And she's like, wait a minute, I would never have done this. So the next thing he does is he frames his mother for stealing the Horn of Proteus and has her thrown in jail and like chained up. And she's there for years. So Glenn, do you want to talk about what your plans were with Lyra and Liren if the book had not been canceled so unceremoniously?
Well, Lyra, I mean, ultimately, during the whole the Atlantis Rising, he was a hero. Liron was actually a hero. He was trying to save his people. He was trying to save, and that's what Vera really wanted. Vera wanted to show that he, because he was in this decrepit body, he was like, he had like dwarfism and whatever else. He was like, he was never taken seriously, but he had ideas and he just wanted what was best for his people. And so ultimately, they came to Namor and said, "You're never around, dude. You're always off with the X-Men or the Avengers doing these other things, and you're trying to, fuck Sue and everything all the time. Why? You're never around." And he's made to realize, you know what? I'm not. We have someone here now who can physically take care of Atlantis with someone who cares about Atlantis. But he would then say to Vera, "But I'm watching you."
So you get to write these characters one more time in the second story in Fantastic Four Unlimited, number 11, with Herb Trimpe, which is a fun combination. I'd love to hear about
That was
working
great.
with Herb.
That was great.
Atlantis has suffered a devastating attack, and there's all these corpses on the ground, and Liren has the military and leaves, like the city is abandoned, but he just leaves Lyra like chained up in this like wreckage. She's just like, it's like very zombie apocalypse. She got chained to the wall and everyone's dead around her. And Namor finds her down there and she's gone a little bit crazy. And she's like, that's not my mind in my son's body. It's that evil scientist who made me like give birth faster. Anyway, Lyra proposes like, "Namor, we can work together. Let's go after Liren." And he's like, "Bitch, no." And he tosses a dead fish at her and is like, "Good luck, like survive as long as you want," and then just leaves her there. And it's so good. It's like he should have killed her probably, but it's so good. Do you want to talk about writing
Yeah,
that? And what was it like to work with?
again, he leaves her alive, right? But he thinks she's as good as dead. But how many times have villains done that to the heroes, right? So,
What was it like working with Herb on this story?
oh, it was great. I was so happy that I got to work with Herb on. I was a little, Herb was kind of doing his Liefeld riff at the time. I was hoping I'd get true Herb on it, but he was doing it was some fun stuff, and it was like, because again, I go back to my history as a comic book fan, and I was a total Hulk fan when I first started collecting comics. And so Herb was the first artist that I ever saw in the comic books. And so it was kind of full circle. Now I'm working with Herb. It was wonderful.
Later this summer on my show, we're going to be doing some episodes related to the rules of Marvel magic. I've got some really fun stuff planned. There was a series of books called Mystic Arcana in the early 2000s by David Sexton, who's one of the handbook team that like I worked with. I've never met David. We get to meet on the show pretty soon, which I'm excited. He's going to be really fun to collab with. But he did a book called Mystic Arcana Scarlet Witch. This is one of those like little series that takes all of the crazy Marvel Divergent stuff and makes some rules for it that make it work. But it's dense. It's like encyclopedic dense. You gotta like make notes and have spreadsheets to make sense of it all. But in this Scarlet Witch Mystic Arcana issue, which some X-Men fans may have read, there's a minor character named Ian McNee who visits sunken Atlantis because he's trying to gather a bunch of artifacts. He sees a swirling sea serpent there, and it's Lyra, as she has like a snake tail now, and she's swimming around undersea Atlantis. He does a reading with her on a spell, and it says, "The creature was once a little girl named Laura, who dreamed of becoming a princess. But Laura grew up to be more than a princess. She became a queen named Lyra. Queen Lyra wore a crown of serpents that was given to her by her master, the elder god Set. But Set took away her serpent crown and left her with a serpent's form instead. Now Lyra guards the crown she once wore. She isn't sure whether her new body is a punishment or a reward, but she is not fond of her new job, and she hates the creature Set as crowned as his new queen, who is the snake woman Nagala." We'll talk about Naga and Nagala another time. So Lyra like bargained with the gods and has now been cursed with this like serpentine body. She fights Nagala. Ian McNee gets involved, and Lyra like mutates farther into a snake creature at the end of this story, and we've never seen her again. What are your thoughts on this wrap up for Lyra in the comics? Does she deserve
You're
it?
asking me.
Both of you, yeah.
I don't think that a lot of this I was wondering, it almost looks like this picks up after the Serpent Crown saga and doesn't take into account anything that happened to her after that. So I was wondering where did this happen? Where did Set come back to her and do this to her? And so
The
it would have
gods
been
don't work
interesting
on
just
your
to know.
human time scale. They will take their revenge whenever they see fit.
Her snake form is kind of fun. Like, it is interesting. And I mean, again, if, so if I were a writer, which I am not, but to like make it make sense in my head, I would think that like Set comes back to be like, hey, I can finally come back now. Like, let's do the thing. And he sees that she's now like this crazy woman tied to a wall who's like barely surviving, and just being like, okay, you get to be snake guardian of the crown now. Like, I'm not gonna leave you here chained, but also, I don't, this is too much crazy for me. Which, I mean, would kind of make sense. And also, like, when Ian McNee does the spell, he's getting the very, like, bare bones Wikipedia entry on, like, on her back from the spell. So, I mean, it's not gonna, like, you would think that with one of her biggest stories being that her son was the king of Atlantis, like, you would think that that would be something that gets, pops on her Wikipedia, but apparently the spell doesn't think so. Which also, like, I don't know, it's also kind of like what a comeuppance for a terrible character being like, yeah, you thought like you were doing something so cool and it's not even a blip on your wiki. Like,
If
you're
any of
like you're
you,
nobody.
if any of you jump to the Marvel appendix, most of the Submariner profiles are written by me. Anything with the name Chad Man at the bottom, that's me. The Liren profile. Liren comes back later in a group called Fathom Five, written by Fabian Nicieza in the New Thunderbolts run, and we've never seen him since. But it's fun to see that character utilized again. He has a lot of potential and a lot of connection to Namor himself. My favorite thing about Lyra is that every story she gets to chew the scenery in a Mr. Sinister kind of way, right? She's so over the top, and writers seem to really have fun with her. Glenn, you seemed like you had a blast writing this character.
I did,
You
yeah.
have
She
for
was
sure had fun drawing her.
yeah. How come you didn't have Demanda do some of the dialogue I wrote?
I
Ooh,
should
Chad,
have.
called out. Called out,
I
Chad.
wanted to frame this with like a heavy-handed approach on her first appearance, and then like summaries of the rest. Not that your dialogue is not amazing. I
Okay.
think it's great. I like to ask people like, what's the Lyra story you need? And what I'm most fascinated by about with this character is what her true origin is. This whole Laura Lyra thing, her place in the mutant world. She has the potential to be like a really fun X-Men villain. Her like mind control of sea creatures and her shape-shifting. She's kind of a crazy lady, and she really wants power. And there's so many innocent mutant characters she could go after. She's obsessed. Lyra versus Magneto is delightful. What are some of the stories you think we need regarding Lyra? And then we'll start our wrap up.
What I did with when I first started writing Namor was he doesn't have control of sea creatures. He can ask, and that's what I always like. And I like that dichotomy with, he doesn't command the sea creatures. He asks for their help. But Lyra, she commands the sea creatures. So that's what I liked, a little bit difference there between the two of them. The story I would like would be, I had a whole bunch of things that were going to be done. I was going to have a whole, all the sea gods during the Atlantis, when Atlantis has risen, now they're all pissed off that there's more land surface and not as much sea surface. They were always told, okay, you won't have as many worshippers, but you'll have more area to reign over. Well, now we don't have as much to reign over, so we want more worshippers. And so there was going to be this whole, and we were going to have Norse god of the sea fight Namor. And I had a lot of things that I wanted to do there. And I wanted to bring Lyra back, and I wanted to, what is her origin? Definitely, who was Lori? What is Lori, was it a congenital twin that it was absorbed into her somehow? Was there, or are there two personalities still there, or did that one personality ultimately die and it's only Lyra? So I really wanted to explore more of that.
Also, what happened to Rhonda?
And what happened to Rhonda? Yes, right. And
Her mom
Carthon.
is still out there. Namor gets pulled into the X-Men world from time to time, especially during their Utopia era. But we have evidence that there are lots of undersea mutants, from characters like Namor, Namora, and Namorita to like more lesser-known characters like Krasta, if anyone knows Krasta.
I was about to say, like, my story would be like having like a crazy adventure where like Krasta and like Loa from the Academy X Days and some other like more aquatic type characters, maybe Squid Boy because he's back now.
I love Squid Boy.
Yes, and like have them just hanging out in the air.
Shark Girl can
Oh
be
yeah,
in there.
oh yeah, and Shark Girl, like,
Shark
and just have
Girl.
them just sort of like, because like we're now post Krakoa and them trying to figure out like, do we want to live in the sea? Do we want to like live on land? And most of them have to like live in both. Maybe coming across Lyra and like having her be like, oh, I can like use these kids because none of them will have probably heard of me. And how can I manipulate these children into getting me, back into power. I think that would be a really interesting little mini series.
There's
Be
also a
like a white
group
queen of the
of,
ocean.
yes, yes. There's also a group of undersea mutants called Surf that are very little known. They show up in that New Mutants annual we mentioned. One is Eel, who can like stretch his body like Mr. Fantastic. One is Shark Skin, who's like super strong. And one is Undertow, who can like control the water around him. There's a ton of super powered Atlantean characters, and there's enough mutant mythology that I think there's some interesting stories that could be explored there. Lyra is the perfect foil for this. Lyra gets involved because is Lyra a mutant too? That's a question I wanted to ask Led as well. Do you think he qualifies as a mutant?
Well, yeah, I definitely. Well, I don't know. If you get powers from your parents, are you a mutant?
It always comes down to, do you have the X gene or not? So
Yeah,
if Lyra has
right.
the X gene and she fucks Namor's nephew, and then her
Yep.
child is born with the X gene, that
The X
would be the
gene,
difference.
then.
He's either a mutate or a mutant. And I think it could be
Yeah.
a mutant. I don't know.
Yeah. If Franklin Richards is a mutant, then why not?
He's not anymore. Go back and
Listen.
see my episode with Tom Brevoort about Franklin Richards. That is definitively to say it stated. He is not a mutant at this point in time.
Okay. All right. Then I don't know if Liron is.
Yeah, I think it just depends on the right writer. I think this character is delicious. I would love to play her off of Selene or Emma Frost or Cyclops.
Could
Shape-shifting into like Emma's form and sneaking into Cyclops's bedroom. Oh my goodness.
but also like trying to have her and Celine do anything together, because who's gonna eat more? Like who's gonna chew up the scenery more, Celine or Lyra? Like it would be incredible.
But we have not stated the one confrontation we must see above all others. Who's the one person that Lyra must get in a fight with?
I don't know.
The Invisible Woman.
Oh, oh
Yeah.
yes.
Right?
I mean, because also, I again, like you kind of mentioned that Sue kind of brushed it off, and it's like, I don't know. I would be mad if someone wore my face to like go like sexually assault someone.
Also, I
Yeah,
want to
it's
fuck
true.
Namor, and you got to do it as me. That's not fair.
Also that. Because like to me it's the same thing. I talked about it when I did X Treats video about Mystique. One of the most baller things that Mystique ever did was put on Carol's face to then murder her boyfriend with her bare hands. And so he thought he was being murdered by Carol. And then she videotaped it and then played it for Carol when she got home.
It's
Like
really
that,
funny.
I mean, it's like that is evil beyond evil. And it's like, yeah, like Mystique and Lyra kind of have that energy.
It's like it's also like really poorly drawn. I don't mean
Oh,
to
yeah.
imply that. Like it's a Claremont story, but it's in a Marvel superheroes book in the early 90s. And you're watching Carol watch her boyfriend slash therapist get beat to death by Mystique in her own form. And Carol's face is just like slowly like it's terrible. I love, we support women's wrongs on this show, everyone.
That's right. We sure
I would love
do.
to hear any final thoughts. And then where can people find you both online? Is there anything you want to plug? We're going to put this out on the Patreon on April 23rd. I had a delightful time with you both. I'm going to be thinking about this character. I fucking want to write the Real Housewives of the Marvel Universe. And we're tossing her right in there with Sue Richards on the other side of the table. And it's going to be great. Mojo's running the whole thing.
Love, love, love,
That would be
love.
awesome.
Let's go Glenn and then Demanda. So final thoughts, where you can be found, and then anything you want to plug.
Well, you can find me. I'm still on Facebook, still the only Glenn Hurdling out there. So you can find me there on Instagram, same thing, only Glenn Hurdling out there. I'm not doing X, sorry, folks. And then, but I like I said in the last episode, I'm going to say here as well, I'm starting a new app. It's called Haddam, stands for Have a Drink on Me. So if you go into a bar and you have the app, you can let your friends know that you're at the bar so that they can join you, or B, your friends can buy you a drink. Brilliant.
That's festive. I love
It's
that.
great to see you, my friend. And I have plans to have you back on already. We're going to hang out with Janice Chang in a few weeks, which I'm very excited about. That's going to be fun.
Looking forward to it. Janice is wonderful.
Demanda Martini, you can find me across most social media platforms. Again, it's mostly Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. Coming up in May, if you are in the Portland, Oregon area on May, don't remember the date off the top of my head, it's fine. I'll be doing the Homo Superior X-Men drag show again in Portland, Portland, Oregon. So if you're in the area, would love to see you out there.
Amanda, I
Coming up.
can't come. I want to, but I can't come this year.
Oh,
So sorry.
that is devastating, but it's okay. It's okay.
My
Oh.
husband got us tickets to the Kilby Block Party locally. It's a whole music festival,
Oh.
and like they were expensive, so I can't go.
So hopefully by April 23rd, we will have announced our new headliner is Jiggly Caliente, famous from RuPaul's Drag Race, which will be very exciting. Also, I have my weekly baking show called To Me, My X Treats, where I bake little treats based on X-Men characters using the Luciano Vecchio trading cards. So in April, because it's my birthday month, I'm doing my favorite characters from the original Excalibur this month. So I hope you guys have been enjoying that. And then in May, I just decided on calling it Miscellaneous May from our friends at the Escape Mojoverse podcast, because it is such a weird conglomeration of characters with the card set. Because it's from Luciano Vecchio's like commissions, there are some characters that like you just like they were just sort of like left over after like some characters just like kind of came together in certain months. So May is just kind of like the leftovers. They're great characters, please don't get me wrong, but they just kind of didn't fit in other months. So we're have Miscellaneous May, and I'm really excited to just like have super random bakes this
You
month.
have such charming energy when you host this little show. It's so delightful. I'm glad to know you. I'm glad the two of you got to meet as well. Like, this is just such a
Too, yeah.
fun crowd, and I can't wait till we all get to hang out in person. And we're gonna be in New York, Glenn, in August. So let's definitely plan like a cocktail
Yeah,
night. We'll all get
please
together.
look me up. Yeah.
Lastly, I'm Chad Anderson. I keep my own social media private because I got kiddos. The two of you are welcome to add me. Just ask. The show you can follow, Grey Malkin underscore Lane on Instagram. The next Patreon coming out immediately after this, we're delving back into the 1980s, into the world of the Micronauts. My friends Daryl and Alan are joining me, and we get to talk all about Acro Year, who's actually a really fucking great character. We're going to talk about it. There's a lot of racial connotation with this character that's really interesting, and he's mostly like a huge triumph, I think, that is largely overlooked. And then out on the main show right after this, we're going to be having the trial of Patsy Walker Hellcat, who's one of my favorite characters. So everybody watch out for that. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I had so much fun today. Thank you, Glenn. Thank you, Demanda. We will see you all back here next time on the Grey Malkin Lane Patreon. And now stay tuned for some thoughts on fascism as a special guest and I talk about a Red Skull story and its modern applications. Beginning in 1964, with the debut of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, a radical faction fighting for mutant supremacy, Marvel's extremist groups have been mirroring shifting global anxieties ever since, beginning back then, surfacing just as the Civil Rights Act was transforming the American landscape. Now, the list I'm about to provide is certainly not comprehensive, but Hydra followed in 1965, espousing fascist world domination in a time when Cold War proxy wars and post-Nazi reckonings were at the forefront of global consciousness. In 1966, we saw three groups emerge that have enormous implications. The Secret Empire, a shadowy cabal manipulating political systems, reflecting pre-Watergate mistrust in the United States government. The Sons of the Serpent, a white supremacist hate group paralleling the violent resistance to desegregation. And AIM, or Advanced Idea Mechanics, a science terror syndicate debuting as the space race intensified fears about unchecked technological advancement. By 1974, the emergence of Black Spectre, a domestic terror cell, and Roxxon, a corrupt mega corporation, respectively, coincided with the Watergate scandal and post-Vietnam corporate cynicism. That's where we're out of my show right now, by the way, and all of this recession-era villain stuff. The corporation was introduced in 1976, which weaponized capitalism and political corruption during America's economic stagflation crisis. In 1979, we meet the National Force, a Nazi-affiliated supremacist group debuting amid renewed far-right movements and the Iran hostage crisis. Remember the Mutant Registration Act in 1981? We also saw that same era the Project Wide Awake program, a government surveillance and control program targeting mutants, eerily echoing Reagan-era rhetoric on law and order and growing fears of authoritarian overreach. In God Loves, Man Kills, we see William Stryker's church waging a holy war against mutants through terrorism, a fundamentalist militia militia driven by apocalyptic beliefs, extremists reflecting someone who might bomb an abortion clinic or take a gun to a gay church. The Scourge of the Underworld, a 1985 vigilante death squad group, emerged at a time of increasing concern over crime and the morality of extrajudicial justice, and they're literally gunning down criminals without trial. The Right, in 1987, an anti-mutant paramilitary covered in the smiling Reaganomic smiles on the green armor. And Ultimatum, the underground liberated, totally integrated mobile army to unite mankind in the mid-1980s, an arachno-terrorist collective. And both of these groups reflected rising global fears of terrorism and ideological extremism. And then we meet around the same time the Watchdogs, with their moral authoritarianism echoing America's rising religious right and censorship crusades. 1988 gives us the Reavers, cybernetically enhanced mutant hunters embodying techno-paranoia and neo-fascism at the tail end of the Cold War. 1990, the Mutant Liberation Front, a militant separatist group debuting as the Berlin Wall fell, highlighting the global upheaval and radicalized youth movements. And the X-Force is the parallel for that group always, of course. And the Church of Humanity in 1990, a fanatical anti-mutant religious cult, violently persecutes mutants as demonic abominations, resembling real-world extremist hate groups that use religion to justify oppression. In 1992, we get the infamous Friends of Humanity, a pseudo-political anti-mutant hate group reflecting the culture war backlash of the early 90s, paralleling rising white nationalistic rhetoric. The New World Order debuts in 1993, another Red Skull-backed fascist syndicate, emerging alongside widespread global conspiracy fears following the Cold War. Humanity's Last Stand in 1995 used deception and false flag attacks to demonize mutants, reflecting real-world paranoia following the Oklahoma City bombing. That same year, we meet Gene Nation, remember Marrow? Formed from traumatized underground survivors of the Morlocks, echoing societal reckoning with systemic neglect and urban decay. Operation Zero Tolerance in 1997, a government crackdown on mutant populations, paralleled increasing post-domestic terror legislation and fears of national surveillance. The Purifiers in 2006, religiously motivated, embodying organized hate's modern rebirth during post-9/11 fundamentalist surges. In 2008, we're jumping ahead just a little bit, we see Norman Osborn literally take over the government as he launches Hammer, a fully armed paramilitary force committing active crimes on United States soil and fully sanctioned to do so. And that's a really uncomfortable parallel for ICE these days, it feels like. And then finally, and again, I'm skipping over a bunch, we have Orcus debuting in 2019 during a peak in real-world nationalism and institutional backlash against progressive movements, who combined scientific authoritarianism and eugenic ambition and societal control and cultural control to preemptively annihilate the future of mutant kind. Together, these organizations, when you form a map this way and put them all in one place, it's kind of chilling. It represents cultural fear, extremism, political manipulation of power across 6 decades of Marvel storytelling, and frankly, the way we define terrorism really shows up here. And this is my kind of early thoughts on this before we begin our discussion. Pay attention to how evil is defined. Terrorist groups like Gene Nation and the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants commit crimes against innocence or structures to raise awareness for mutant causes. The murder is, of course, evil, but it's a very different kind of hate group evil that exists. Some of these hate groups are about secret groups of men doing secret things politically. Others are about hate directly, fascist white supremacism that wants to target a specific population. Others are about government-controlled initiatives to keep the peace by silencing, quote, woke groups. Again, Operation Zero Tolerance. And then the last category is the ones that are very ultra-Christian, using Jesus or God as the divine right for the terrorist groups to oppress others. Now realize one quick thing. The Gene Nation and the Brotherhood, they killed innocents, yes, but they did not seek to conquer the planet or build concentration camps. Even the Acolytes in their moments of cruelty were seeking awareness for causes. But literally every other group ends up being pro-fascist, active oppression spaces, pro-Christian often, pro-conservativism, and pro-white nationalism, while hoarding billions and building concentration camps, and covering up things like pedophilia and money laundering. So literally all of these groups end in the same place, which is concentration and internment camps. It's insane. So how do we define evil, friends? Two words, Red and Skull. So let's jump to Amazing Spider-Man, numbers 320 through 325. Staying behind the scenes, we see the Red Skull manipulating events around the world, weaponizing agents from Ultimatum and the Watchdogs, while completing terrorist activities around the world. He orchestrates the assassination of the Simkarian Prime Minister Limca at the hands of Sabretooth, who shows up here, and begins manipulating events in the lives of superheroes and mercenaries, including Spider-Man, Captain America, Silver Sable, and Solo, the mercenary, all in an effort to drive the United States and Simcaria to war. When the Red Skull is finally exposed as behind it all, several are dead, and the Skull is ordering the destruction of the United States Constitution, the burning of the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights, and he plans to frame both countries, Simcaria and the United States, for evil acts in other countries. Quote, "The resulting war would be so debilitating, making it so much easier for me to work from within to destroy the United States." Red Skull tries bribing Spider-Man for $1 million to work for him. The hero refuses, and the Red Skull kind of easily abandons his plot, but that's because he's doing about 75 other evil things in this same era while living in his Captain America clone body. Let me welcome my dear friend Theodate Chase back to the show to talk about this crazy story. Theo, are you a Red Skull fan?
He makes a good villain. You see a lot of people, especially X-Men fans, who will lament the fact that there aren't like straight up evil villains anymore. And I think the Red Skull will always, the advantage of the Red Skull is that he will always occupy that space. He will always be the embodiment of evil.
Who's the parallel for the Red Skull in the X-Men franchise? I mean, the Red Skull, they fight him directly too, but Magneto is not an apt comparison.
No, because the Red Skull's whole thing, even down to his origin, is that he was meant to be just this embodiment of like chaos, like an evil. Like, I think there's, I mean, if you want to talk about, there's plenty of that argument never holds water with me because there's plenty of like anti-mutant, like bigoted, like fascist villains that the X-Men fight. They're just not the evil, quote unquote, evil mutant.
I feel like William Stryker is kind of an odd parallel, or even Bastion in his way. Like we almost had to create these like ultimate anti-mutant evils and then veil it under patriotism or anti-national or anti, well, yeah, anti-wokeness, I suppose, is the easiest way to phrase that in 2025. Okay, before we get too ahead of ourselves, let me hear your thoughts on the Amazing Spider-Man story I had you look into. I'm assuming this is a story you had read before.
It is, yeah. I read a lot of the 90s, like McFarlane Spider-Man when I was younger, where everybody's eyes are bigger than their heads and everybody, and but it's all very dynamic in motion. This story is politically confusing, I think is the biggest thing, because you have all these different plots and characters going on at the same time. Red Skull is behind it all, but he's working with different organizations, including the Watchdogs, of course, who you would expect that's his right-wing fascist group, and but also Ultimatum, who are anarchists, and the Resistance appear, who are a mutant rights group.
Oh,
Like his
yeah, we didn't
minion.
talk about the Resistance. Yeah, so Resistance is a group of mutants who have taken refuge in a city. Peepers is there, Mentallo is there. They are fomenting protests against the government. And it's very parallel to groups like ACT UP, who were protesting during the AIDS crisis in its odd way. But what the Red Skull has done here is he's taken groups that other people define as terrorists and either hired certain people to dress as them because it turns people against everyone. He's done this in other stories with anarchists, even with like Black Panther derivatives. Like, if I can take anything that Americans hate and then show them that those people are equitable with Nazis, that will make them hate those people even more. Does that parallel make sense? Like, it's not the same cause. Ultimatum is not Nazism. It's anarchy. It's the dissolution of borders. The Resistance are not Nazis. They're anti-capitalism. They're anti-oppression. But they're still terrorists, the way that modern America would define them. So the Red Skull's putting his label on their cause to turn the cause against them. Again, direct parallels to 2025.
Yeah, it's interesting timing for asking me to talk about this because my recent special interest has been the history of the U.S. Intelligence apparatus. So I've been reading a lot about like how like J. Edgar Hoover described terrorism and like enemies and things like that to the United States. And it was never really about the ideals. It was never about like what they specifically were calling for or acting for. It was just if they disrupted the status quo, they were the enemy. And like you have things in this book, like part of why Captain America and Spider-Man are involved because they're trying to prove that the United States, specifically the CIA, didn't order the assassination of the Prime Minister of Silver Sable's Simcha. Yeah, I can never say the name of that country. I've read it a million times.
Simcaria.
Simcaria's Prime Minister is like the assassination of the Simcarian Prime Minister is blamed on the CIA, and they're like, oh, it can't be the CIA, despite the fact that assassinating leaders of independent countries is something known to be a thing that the CIA
Yeah,
has
well,
done
and
in the
Sim Carrier
past.
rarely gets the primary focus in the books for any length of time, but there are long-running stories, even in the last couple of years, where Sim Carrier is at war and making political deals and trying to survive on the borders. They recently got acquired by Latveria, and then there's a bunch of like stories fomenting like political disruption there. This is a country, again, Silver Sable is the connecting point, but this is a country that has a long history in comics as well.
Yeah, I find the idea interesting that it's not about that this idea that terrorism is the evil, regardless of what any of these one groups are fighting for, like what they're calling for. It doesn't matter what the resistance or ultimatum or the watchdogs want, even if they're in counter purposes, because at the end of the day, you can just slap the label of terrorism and that makes them the bad guys. And you
Yeah.
get that a lot with that very black and white thinking with the character of Solo, who's basically the Punisher, if the Punisher specifically targeted terrorists instead of like organized crime.
Right, but also Solo's a lot more whiny.
Yeah.
Yeah, these are really interesting. When you heard me kind of recounting the history of these terror groups at Marvel, isn't it jarring to see them all in one place that way?
Yeah, it's every writer seems to pop up a new one. So we just have all these countless groups and some run parallel. And I think that some run parallel, some have similar goals, some have opposing goals. They're all just kind of there. And I think that does parallel like real life anxieties too, is that in real life, a lot of people can't seem to keep track of all these different groups and what they want. So it's easier to just say this is all one thing. And especially with how Americans react to say Middle Eastern groups, because they don't want to like it, because that's such a complicated and complex area that people for a long time had no real understanding of.
Yeah.
They didn't really know the difference between one group versus another. And you get that in comics as well with all these different like more fantastical like super groups, but it's
Yeah.
still.
Well, and always read through the lens of the superhero who, along the way, have to learn harsh lessons about what that means. We see Spider-Man learning a lesson here, right? The big decision at the end of this is let's take the American tryhard, who's definitely a hero. The way we define heroism is like acts of sacrifice and acts of bravery. But the Red Skull basically saying, "Hey, I'll give you $1 million," and the hero takes a minute to like turn that idea down, right? Which is what makes him a hero. But it's kind of a parallel to what we're all going through these days. What are we willing to take to keep us comfortable while ignoring the great evils around us? Because had Spider-Man made that decision at the end, he would be playing along. So we draw the 2025 comparison, right? It's been a long time in comics where you can't really trust the person who says that they're good and noble unless they show you they're good and noble, because there's always a Red Skull puffing a cigarette in the background, manipulating events. Look over there while I do this evil thing over here. And the weaponization of information too, right? Like, I did this thing, but I told you they did it, so now you have to believe me and then give me money to do this other thing that I want to do, right?
You brought up a good point earlier I hadn't really considered, because I was really confused why there was a resistance member in this like group, but I hadn't considered the possibility that Red Skull was just trying to manipulate situations by having his minions dress as these different groups. Like Ultimatum is definitely there, like part of this, but like then you get the smaller groups that appear near the end, like Resistance, where there's only like one member and he's carrying a gun rather than like using mutant powers. So it's like, is that actually a member of this group who's part of this, or is Red Skull just trying to make it seem like it's all one thing?
So, Theodate, how are you doing in 2025 America? Let's draw the modern implications here. We have all kinds of weaponization of news. We have paramilitary forces that are working for the government. So, technically, we can't call them terrorists, but my word, can we definitely call them terrorists? We're seeing internment camps. We're seeing the reduction of rights. Everything's on fire. It's crazy.
I feel it's so stressful to basically watch people in power implement decisions and changes that are going to be things our like great great grandkids are going to be dealing with. Like to this day, we're still dealing with things that were done by people in power like decades ago, and we're watching that happen again, where it's going to be an uphill climb. And to answer your question, I mean, not doing great. I don't know that anybody is, but part of what you got to do at this time is to stick to your morals, stick to your, like, help those in your community. And that's definitely what I've been trying to do, is be part of the groups that are heading in the right direction.
Yeah. You and I have known each other for a while now. I get to check in with you every few months. I know you are changing a lot of things, and to live boldly and to live joyfully in the face of this kind of oppression is an act of defiance. It's an act of joy every day that we choose to fight back. Making these little Red Skull conversations has been so healing for me, because it's helping me see things so clearly.
Not to talk around it, I've been openly transitioning, living as more as a woman, as a queer woman publicly, and I picked definitely a time to do it. And part of it is just that I feel that I need to, you got to be yourself. And I mean, no, like, I understand why people will feel the need to protect themselves and stay more contained. But for me, it felt important that I had to be openly myself. And when the rest of the world is saying this isn't the time to be that.
I get this joy as a therapist. I get to walk people through transition over time. And I'm not your therapist, obviously, but every time I see you, you're a little more yourself, which is such a beautiful thing to witness anytime. As people learn how to love themselves, there's never been a more important time to live your truth and to speak your truth. So super fucking proud of you just for living at this pace that you're living, my friend. Whatever speed that is, I am here as your friend and your ally. And I can't wait to hang out again on the main show very soon. Any concluding thoughts for today, Theodes?
As for the story, I had fun revisiting this. I haven't gone back and reread any 90s Spider-Man since I read it the first time when I was a lot younger. And it was a fun time. A lot of dynamic art, a lot of interesting stories. I always enjoy seeing Silver Sable and things. She's a fun character. Yeah. It's funny. I find characters like Paladin and Solo endlessly exhausting. Both of them appear in this, like the gun-toting mercenary guy. But then you get the gun-toting mercenary woman and it's like, oh yeah, she's awesome.
Silver Sable can kick all of their asses. I really liked her with Nightcrawler. That's a story. That's a conversation for
another. Oh yeah. That was a fun story.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. We will see you back here next time, where my friend Phil Seavey is going to join me to talk about Red Skull versus Magneto. Yep, that's a story that happened.